Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. Coming to you from the sunny city of Angels where, man, did Magic Johnson just go hold my beer to UCLA basketball, right? Because UCLA basketball was the dysfunctional disaster of a search for new leadership, which culminated in the hiring of Mick Cronin, press conference later on today, which I actually think is pretty good hire. But it's like, that was a mess. And then the Lakers are like, oh, wait, you think that's a mess? Hold my beer. Doug Gottlieb Show brought to you by Farmers. At Farmers, we've seen almost everything, so we know how to cover almost anything. When it's game time, have an experienced player help you stay ahead of the game. Put their experience into play at Farmers.com. We are Farmers. Dum da dum 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 dum. There we go. Cool. All right. Kyle Guy, hero for the national champion Virginia Cavaliers, going to join us in 15 minutes. Caron Butler, tough juice, former NBA All-Star. He'll join us half past the hour. Then the head coach of the Wahoos will join us. Tony Bennett, top of next hour. Eric Musselman, or Muss, as he's known in the business, will join us next hour. And then Rick Riley's going to join us in studio. We'll talk some golf. We'll talk about his new book. We'll talk about some Masters with the patrons in a tradition unlike any other. Man, do we got a lot to get to. Can we start with Magic Johnson? Okay, so here's what happens. Here's what happens. Okay. Generally, when you get to the end of the season, if the big boss is there, it means you're going to get fired at the end of the season. Right? Magic Johnson was not always in attendance. You know, he had Michigan State's Final Four run. He has other appearances. He has other business interests. And the general thought around the Lakers was, if you see Magic, that means Luke should bring in his playbook. He apparently had gone and gotten clearance from Jeannie Buss to fire Luke Walton before the game. And by all reports, apparently wanted to fire Rob Pelinka, who's the general manager of the Lakers. And so instead, he has an impromptu press conference where he resigns. Wow. And I mean, it was a stunner, and it was kind of out of nowhere. And if you thought that the Lakers knew it was going to happen, there was no podium, there was no dais, there were no dignitaries. This was not the way that Magic would traditionally do it. Right? Magic's about big. Magic's about showy. This is a guy who spends a month every summer on a yacht traveling around the world. Magic is not somebody who walks in quietly and just, hey, man, I think I'm going to step aside and go on to something else. So there's a lot of questions that are still left unanswered. There's a lot of rumors out there. But in the meantime, here's Magic Johnson sharing what went wrong with the Lakers.
What I didn't like is the backstabbing and the whispering. I don't like that. You know, I don't like a lot of things that went on that didn't have to go on. And so I hope that after tomorrow, the Lakers can head in the right direction, which we are.
The backstabbing, huh? The rumors, huh? Here's what he said about his relationship with general manager Rob Pelinka.
I got to know Rob. I didn't know Rob before Jeannie put us together. And so it took us a while. You know, we had to get to know each other. My relationship got a good relationship.
Is it as good as you'd like? Had it been better?
With Rob?
Yes.
What? No. The relationship with Rob is fine. I just didn't know him, and he didn't know me. And we got put together. And so I think we had to get to know each other and then learn how to work with each other. So we did that. But, you know, it has nothing to do with me stepping down, if that's what you're asking me.
That is not exactly a ringing endorsement, right? Remember, this is the only front office in the league that does not have an assistant general manager. Rob Pelinka, who's the longtime agent of Kobe Bryant, and obviously if they don't know each other, and that means and Kobe and Magic aren't exactly boys. And it wasn't like he's like, no, I love Rob. Rob's my guy. Yeah, we didn't know each other beforehand, but man, I just feel better for having known him. I mean, we can see what this is, right? We were born at night, but just not last night. The idea that we can sit here and listen to Magic Johnson tell us he didn't like the backstabbing, he didn't like the rumors, and not have any sort of praise until today on Twitter towards Rob Pelinka tells you all you need to know. And then you read this from Peter Vesey, got his own site. Rob Pelinka is the most disrespected agent ever, snapped a hardened executive. There's no bigger liar. Magic made a break for it. This is from Peter Vesey. I'm guessing for good reason, because he knew damaging assertions were coming. His desertion may have been sudden, but it was not surprising. Most assertions center on what his non-existent work ethic. Magic was never there. And then he got mad because Rob Pelinka would say he's never there. And of course, he was so defensive about not being there and not liking the progress that he was going to fire everybody else, even though he wasn't really as much a part of the process as he should have been. It's the classic tale. Athletes think we have great work ethic. And generally, I believe that you hire great athletes. You hire athletes because they do. They do push through pain. They do push through other boundaries. But star athletes are completely different. They're so coddled. They're so protected that they're never called on their own mistakes, or they're never ever called on their own inadequacies. They're just not. You also have to remember that Magic Johnson is a guy who... I think people deemed as some genius businessman in Los Angeles because he was always Magic and, you know, putting movie theaters in South Central Los Angeles and owning Starbucks was seen as some groundbreaking move. But the real Magic is outside of the court, is the coaching disaster, is the late night talk show disaster, is the guy who had nothing really to do with the reinvention of the Dodgers, and the guy who opined for the job, stabbed everyone else in the back to get the job, then finally got the job and didn't want to do what was necessary to complete the job. And, of course, there's these stories out there that there's some sort of ESPN slam piece that is upon us and that maybe he got out ahead of it. All of that makes sense. Because to walk up in front of the cameras 3-4 hours before you're supposed to fire the head coach and you got approval to do so and say, to hell with it, I'm out, doesn't make sense. Doesn't make any sense. So, look, I think that the Lakers job is a big-time job. I would guess that all the big boys in the NBA will want it. And when they get it, they'll clean house. And the only question is, how do they handle the LeBron situation? The second question is, can they get the right guy so that they become a destination for free agents again? But what a fascinating turn of events in LA, where what was a foregone conclusion that Luke Walton would be fired last night or today is suddenly not at the forefront. Instead, it's, why would Magic Johnson pull the ripcord after he got some form of support from Jeannie Buss to fire the head coach? Felt like Magic fired himself last night, and he should have, from a job that he thought he wanted but didn't actually want to do. What else is behind it? More to come.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
We've had 48 hours or so, and I want to catch up with the head coach of the new national champions, the Virginia Cavaliers. He's Tony Bennett. He joins us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. Coach, I don't know how much you slept. I know you started returning a bunch of texts yesterday because you and I text each other back and forth. I can't imagine what your cell phone is like, but I want to ask you first, what's it like to wake up, open your eyes for the second time, knowing you're a national champion?
I got a little better sleep last night. It's same feeling. Fortunate, humbled, thankful, the whole deal. And, you know, again, as our guys, we talk about it, I don't know if it's fully, you know, sunk in yet. Little pieces come, and I think the appreciation, all that will continue. But it was such a hard fought, you know, the way we did it is improbable, and it makes it even that much sweeter.
Yeah, I said yesterday, like, I've never understood, and maybe more fans, and sometimes it's coaches and players, the defensiveness that comes with when you say, hey, they were a little lucky, or even a lot lucky. But I mean, look, there's a lot of, and luck is when timing and preparation kind of come together. That's how it's always been described to me. But there's a lot of ways to describe three consecutive games in which you have improbable, very, very late comebacks to wins. Are you defensive at all if somebody says, hey, they were at least a little bit lucky?
Not at all. We were. You call it whatever. Blessed, fortunate, lucky. Who knows? You know, even this is the first year in the NCAA tournament we've been fully healthy, and so much of the NCAA tournament comes down to who you're playing. Obviously, who's hot. We played some hot teams. Who you're playing, are you healthy? And then those bounces, those plays. So that happened. The Oregon game was so tough too. So that's real stuff. But no, I'm not defensive one bit about that, and I think it's right.
All right, let me go to the semifinals, because I thought you guys had that game in hand, and then all of a sudden Ty Jerome, who has only had four fouls once this season, and that was the game against Purdue. So he's a guy who never fouls out. Your team commits only 14 fouls as a team per game. It's something you guys harp on, preach on, and it's, you know, one of the basis of your guys' success. You took him out of the game, and all of a sudden Auburn makes a run. You guys kind of lost your offensive rhythm. In the moment, take me through your thought process when he commits what was a silly foul because he thought he was fouled on a post-up.
You're right. That's something you would do and I would probably do. You're like, hey, come on, I got hit. And he lost his head. He described it himself as a boneheaded play. So I said, what are you doing? Because, you know, it happened. And Auburn made an incredible comeback because we were playing high-level basketball. And in all these games, about we've got to have luck. Well, you still got to be in that spot to win it. So it has to be high-level plays through the course of the game. But we had a terrific second half, and then they were so quick to start making plays. Yeah, and I think exactly when Ty did that, and he just lost his head for a second, fouled. And, you know, I was faced with a decision. I think it was at about the 5:40 or somewhere right around 5-minute mark. And I thought, okay, do we just sit him? And my thought was just sit him for a minute, get him under the media timeout, or at some point to see, but I think it was maybe a 7-point game at that time. So again, it shows you his value. His role on this team. We have so many terrific players in Hunter and Guy and all that, but he's kind of like the Tom Brady, you know, for us, who just makes everything go. And when he came out, we did lose our. They started making some plays, tough contested threes, missed the block out, and then he had to get back in fairly quickly. But that was, you know, obviously a key for their comeback and, you know, us kind of faltering.
What's that feeling like? Look, you were a great player, and you can undersell it all you want to other people. You can't undersell it to me. Tony Bennett, our guest on the Doug Gottlieb Show. You're a great player. What's that feeling like to have a kid like Kyle Guy, who I remember calling your games when he was a freshman. He had that terrible man bun, right? And you told me, like, he just... He's got a confidence about him that you don't want to take away. Like, you want him to take good shots and buy into what, but there's a confidence to him that is unmistakable. What's that like to stand there and watch him stare down those three free throws and knock him down? In your heart of hearts, what's going on in your mind?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, even statistically, free throw wise, Kyle, I don't think he doesn't knock it out of the park. I actually don't know it offhand. And I remember when that happened, just I didn't know if he was going to make them or miss one. Or I just thought, well, I literally was like, here we go. You know, I didn't even think, like, oh, he's got these for sure. And someone said, and I was standing next to him, I didn't hear it, but where they interviewed him right after, and he said, I was terrified, I think, when he stepped to the line. I don't know if that was for Hollywood or if he really was, but those were strong shots because they went in pretty pure, bang, bang, bang. They did the timeouts. But I was just thankful. All right, we got a chance to tie it or send or win it. I'm like, the way our Purdue game ended, I was kind of like, well, this would be fitting, wouldn't it now? And so it was like, here we go. I was hopeful, but in my mind thinking, okay, do we get someone at the free throw? You stay in the moment like, okay, if he makes, what are we doing? If he misses, what are we doing? Where are we putting our pieces? And that's really what was going on in my mind.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the Purdue game, and I hate to go out of kind of chronological order, but even though the Purdue game, there was all those things, Kihei making the right read and throwing it to Mama D, but part of the way you guys got the ball back is one of the things that's unique about how you guys play. Even though you don't necessarily send a bunch of guys to the offensive boards, between Mama D and Salt and maybe DeAndre, but really Mama D does an incredible job of tipping the ball out and giving you guys additional possessions. That's something that's taught, right? I mean, like, look, he has to have the length and the skill to do it, but that's something you work on, isn't it?
Well, Jack Salt and him were key. You know, of course, we talk about those big three, but I think the X factors this whole tournament run were Kihei Clark, Mamadi, and of course, Jack in that game particularly. But that all started, you know, guys, Isaiah Wilkins was one of the best we've had at that. And you know, when you play with a player who's effective at doing something, your other guys just sort of say, yeah, that's a way to keep stuff alive. And there's such athleticism, you know, and size in the game. So sometimes you can't grab it. Best thing you can do, and I didn't mention Braxton Key, what he did in the championship game with that rebounding and defense, but is just, I can't grab it, so I'm keeping it alive, and, you know, that's definitely something. I think Isaiah just sealed it in even more how it was effective.
You know, you bring up Key, and he did have a huge championship game, but I also think it speaks to you and your ability to read the game on the fly, because Kihei struggled, you know, a little bit with their size, with their length, and really they're just older guys, right? I mean, he's a kid; they're grown men, and I thought you made, and they kind of changed their lineup. They went to a little bit of a small ball lineup, and it caused you to change. Was that part of your plan to play Key that much in the championship game, or is that something you felt as the game went on?
I felt that as the game went on, and Doug, I'm going to give you some credit. You and I had a conversation. You know, we go back so many years, you know, our fathers were both, you know, legendary coaches who've poured so much into us. And after last year's UMBC game, you know, you and I talked. I can't remember if we did an interview or not, but you talked. And you challenged me and encouraged me that, you know, obviously like everyone would grow from this game. But, you know, can you find ways when the tournament comes to play differently, even through the year, try different things, whether it's offensively or defensively, or lineup wise. And I remember that conversation, and I knew we had to do that because, you know, obviously we were good last year, and DeAndre Hunter allowed us to play small. And then when DeAndre got hurt in the NCAA tournament, before that we didn't have that four guard lineup. Well, this year when Braxton and Key got eligible, I knew at times we're going to be able to play Key as a five and Dre as a four, or vice versa, and a real small lineup. And then against Purdue, we needed to go big with Salt and Mamadi. So you kind of challenged me. We added some things, and I really tried to think hard about that. And I thought in tournament runs, you need to be able to have the versatility to mix things up offensively or defensively. We used the offense against Texas Tech in the championship game that we hadn't hardly used all year because they ran a different kind of defense with the way they forced it on the side and switched. And so you have to have those things ready in those situations.
Yeah, that was. I'll tell you exactly what it was.
I might have just got you a head coaching job, Doug. I just got you a head coaching job, so I want a piece of that. All right.
Oh, that's fine. You collect a percent. Here's the progress of how process of how it went down. You guys lost. Obviously, I'm sure everybody reached out to text you. I texted you. We texted back and forth. I think we did do an interview, and then you and I talked for about an hour. And what I said and was like, you know, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid even to lose a game or to lose momentum, in a regular season game, because you never know. Like, try stuff. Like, look, your teams are good enough that you're going to get to the NCAA tournament. And so why not, whether it's a guarantee game or an ACC game, try different lineups and try different things because, you know, I mean, look, Texas Tech, they went to a small ball lineup there. That's not their traditional lineup because, you know, Owens was hurt and in foul trouble, and they couldn't score against your bigs. And the only way to do it was to drag your bigs out on the floor, right? So those things that you have to kind of prepare for. Okay, so then you did something that you hadn't done the entire game when you're down three, or I don't remember you doing it, where I thought as well coached as they are, I thought leaving Odiasi in after he made the second free throw gave you the mismatch you needed. You had a small lineup, and you set kind of a side ball screen with his man. Had you done that before in the game?
At what point? Something broke up there. You said when we went what? I missed last part, Doug. Sorry.
Okay. You're down three with, what, 15 seconds to go?
Yes.
They make the second free throw, and instead of taking the big guy out, Odiasi, they leave him in, and you set a screen with his man kind of to the side of the court. That's what freed Ty Jerome up to get the drive and kick. Had you set that ball screen before in the game?
No, and similar to the Auburn game, and you know, as a coach, we learned this, you have to save some things. At times, different little, a quick little action that they can play out of, and open up different things, and that they maybe haven't seen. And you know, Brendan Sir, who actually he always talks about that. You get in the tournament, you just have to have something that might look a little different under four or whatever, because you just need a possession of everything. And we did it against Auburn a couple times, and actually a few things happened there. So no, that was the first time we had. You do something early in the game sometimes just to get a look and see how do they handle this. That may look similar, so I just did a couple things to just get a gauge for what they do, and then so when we got to that spot, it was kind of probably the second time we did it, but we did it a little different.
I know you got to run. I got two more for you, really quick. DeAndre Hunter, who had struggled with his jump shot at times, and he struggled kind of out of the gate. Did you say something to him because he was simply remarkable in that game?
Yeah.
How did he kind of personally turn it around?
I thought you saw him grow up before our very eyes. I was telling DeAndre, you know, he's just scratching the surface. Do not be defined by a mistake in your game or missing shots. I said, that's something every really great player has to overcome. If you're missing, and young players, if they miss a couple shots or have a mistake, they sort of shy away. And I thought he guarded hard all game. We talked about that leading up to the Final Four. You know, look, if I look at you and tap you on the leg, I think you're getting a little discouraged. You snap out of it, I said, because this team feeds off you on the glass, and the way he spread out and slid on Culver all game, I said, you have to give us that, irregardless of your offensive output. But I knew we needed him, and I thought he struggled a little early, maybe settled in the Auburn game, and then all of a sudden the second half of both of those, but the championship game, he got assertive, started making plays, and just, it was unmistakable. So that's the credit to him and part of the maturity process of maybe going through that in the tournament earlier or other games and not responding quite the same as he did in the Final Four.
Last thing, your family and your faith are everything to you. What'd your dad say?
We can appreciate this, Doug, more than most because we know how much they've poured into our lives in both areas that are so important to us. But he just was happy. You know, he didn't come to the Final Four game, my father, but he wanted to be there for that championship game. He gets so nervous, but it was just a shared moment. I could just see in his eyes, and his handprint was all over me. He prepared me to coach in that moment in that game because I know our system and style gets a lot of criticism, which really doesn't matter, but when you play elite competition, you better have a way that's sound and can hold up in the pressures of the game against elite players. And that was on display for me in my mind. All right, we know we have to do these things that have been ingrained in me as a coach and a player ever since he started working with me. And that's the stuff I tried to just execute, have our team execute at the highest level. And then, you need to start the way you start. You need the luck, and you need the players to make plays. And our players made plays, so that's why it was good. And special moment with my family and with him.
Well, well-deserved respect. Hey, thanks so much for the compliment, and thanks so much for your time. Look forward to seeing you in the upcoming offseason, but enjoy the victory lap. It's well-deserved, and of course, it represents a style of basketball which your dad believed in and so many believed in, and finally has come to fruition. Congratulations.
Thank you, Doug.
Pleasure's mine. Tony Bennett, head coach of the Wahoos. The Virginia Cavaliers, national champions for 2019.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
For my lifetime, every Wednesday, you'd go to the mailbox and you would get your Sports Illustrated. At my mom's house in Orange, California, if you go into her garage, she's a bit of a pack rat, and she may well be listening, and she'll nod her head a little bit when I say this. There are several boxes that have all the first, second, third editions of Sports Illustrated, the first year, the second year, third year. I remember because one time I was like in high school, I go digging through boxes and I found them. It's like, these are like gold. And my dad was a subscriber. And anyway, Wednesdays it would come out, and whoever the cover person for Sports Illustrated would be, you know, like the legend of the week. And then you turn to the back page and you read Rick Riley's piece. And Rick Riley kind of spent some time with us here on the week where his book, Commander in Cheat, drops, and it's already number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. Congratulations
to
you.
That's crazy. You know, it's funny because that's how I got into sports writing, because my cousin kept them all. And I remember being like 6, 7 years old and like, what is this? And all these great pictures and Zolio Versailles. I remember him from the Twins was on the cover. And then I'd go over, every time I'd go to his house, I'd start, first you'd look at the pictures.
Right.
Then you'd steal a picture with the scissors, put it on your room. And then I started reading Dan Jenkins. And Dan Jenkins, like, whoa, what is this? And then I started reading my local paper, and it was Jim Murray, the great Jim Murray. Like, whoa, I've never read anything like this either. And I started realizing you could write sports in a completely fun, pithy, irreverent, meaningful way, I think. Right. That wasn't all about stats and what they hit on Tuesdays. And I tried never to use numbers. I tried to make it about people who did sports, good or bad, funny, mad, angry, whatever. And that really made all the difference.
Your first column in Sports Illustrated was about who or about what? You remember?
Dale Murphy. They gave me 10 pages in the back. And I go there and he like, Rick, I'm not going to give you any time for this, but I want you to come to my house for dinner tonight and I'll tell you why. And he did all this great stuff, and his wife made a pie and just gave me great stuff. And he goes, so that's why I can't do it. I'm like, dude, we already got the piece. And it really was great. And that's really what got me. It went so well. I got more and more assignments.
Okay. So we've reached this place with Tiger Woods where he went from being the greatest thing we've ever seen to a villain to now. Then he was a sympathetic figure, right, where we felt sorry for him. And there was the thought he would never play golf again. And I've told people, like, look, a couple things. You're never too drunk to fish, and you're never too old to play golf. and so I always thought that there would be at least one Sunday at Augusta where he probably won. Because even after Elin caught him, and there's the golf club and the car accident. I remember I was at ESPN then, and I was set to be on ESPN2 on Thanksgiving weekend.
We were 2009.
Doing college basketball wraps, and they're like, fellas, you guys can go home. It's like, why? Like, Tiger Woods was in a car accident, and it doesn't look good. I was like, doesn't look good? Like, he's going to die? And that was the first talk was, it doesn't look good. Then it was like, no, he doesn't look good because everything else is going to come out. So we end up staying and doing the basketball rap, but it became the biggest story. Anyway, we've had these different, now he's someone who he appears to be mostly back, granted, a completely different version of himself. When you see Tiger Woods at a place that you've covered 35 different times at Augusta, what are the emotions that go through you watching him when he's going to tee off tomorrow?
Well, I have no emotions about him, his golf game, which is fantastic. He's the most skilled person I've ever seen with a golf set of golf clubs. But I don't get, how is he a sympathetic figure? He got busted twice for pills, illegal pills he shouldn't have had.
Yeah.
He had to be woken up twice in cars by cops on the side of the road. All his injuries were self-inflicted. He did this to himself. He tried to be an Army Ranger and couldn't because his dad was military.
Right.
He had 14 affairs going on against one of the hottest women I've ever seen was his wife. So he's got $500 million. I don't get why everyone's like, oh, no, we want Tiger so bad. He's terrible with fans. He's finally being a little nicer in interviews and smiles a little, but Phil never passes up a fan. Phil tips with hundreds. I mean, I have so many tipping stories where Tiger just stiffs the guy, or he doesn't eat dessert, so he gets up from the table and leaves no money for anybody to pay his. He was famous too young. His dad absolutely let him get away with whatever he wanted outside the golf course. And so I think he was raised very, very poorly. And yeah, great golfer, incredible story. But I don't get this, oh, I really want Tiger to win. You want a great kid to win who could be the, could at least try to keep up with Tiger. Root for Rory. That is a great guy who could win the career slam this weekend. I mean, he's fantastic. Ricky Fowler, Jordan Spieth, couldn't be a nicer kid who's great with everybody. So I'm not a Tiger fan outside the course. Inside, he's absolutely one of the top five players in the world right now. He almost won his last two majors. Almost, remember, he won. He led Sunday at Carnoustie.
Mm-hmm.
He almost won at St. Louis, except Brooks Koepka would put on a show like I've never seen. Otherwise, he might have his major already.
Rick Riley, our guest here on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. You live in L.A. You're an L.A. native, so you know. You know that this Magic Johnson story is front page news. Even we say it, even though most people don't read by the paper anymore. What's your immediate reaction? Magic Johnson, it's not just that he quit. It's that he just had a meeting with Jeannie Buss, and then he walks downstairs and says, you know what, by the way, I don't want to do this anymore.
That was so un-Magic-like. He's one of my favorite people. But I don't, even when he took the job, I'm like, really? You're going to work hard at this? Because I don't see you working hard at this. Because Magic is Magic. He puts his arm around you and looks you in the eye and remembers your name. And he always with me is like, oh, this is one of the cool guys. I'm not sure he remembers my name, but right. He always gives you that magic. And he's really personable. And I don't know, but every other job he's kind of had was like, come on, sell these guys, sell the suites, get LeBron in. Great. You can do all that because nobody's more magical. But if you want him to make a whole study of how they're going to build, that's never going to be him.
I'm just surprised that he didn't hire somebody. Right?
Yeah.
Like just having Rob Pelinka, who he didn't hire, and not, they have no assistant GM, right? There's no, he's not surrounded by a cast of people.
Between Pelinka and him, they have zero experience.
Right.
So why?
And their head coach had zero head coaching experience.
But there's always some little third guy that does all the work, but I don't see anybody.
No.
Yeah, it's too bad. He's a great guy.
Rick Riley.
He really stepped on it here.
He did. And I don't think it ruins, but it does sully the image to those of us who grew up in Southern California like I did. Like, dude, Magic can do no wrong. And now you're like, well, he didn't really do anything with the Dodgers. And the talk show was bad and the head coaching was bad. Like, but he was awesome when he played. Now he becomes an awesome player who's kind of, you start to question anything else he's done as, was he really responsible for the success?
But that's so unfair.
I didn't say it was fair. I never said it was fair. Like, none of these things are fair, but it is the reality.
You judge a man by his body of lifetime work, and he's been nothing but great and a success and achiever. And I mean, okay, he kind of stepped on this thing, but
he was terrible as an analyst for both ESPN and NBC.
And he was terrible on talk shows.
And as a head coach.
Yeah, he was terrible.
Outside of that, he was amazing.
That's why my guy Elway never gets any love. Like, they want to fire him in Denver. How many great players did really well at being the boss?
He's also been to two Super Bowls.
Yeah.
As an executive too.
And five as a player. So that's seven, and they want to fire him in my hometown of Denver. Like, what? Don't fire him. You should build a new capital with his face on it.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Rick Riley continues to join us. His new book is called Commander in Chief.
Could you show it?
I will. I'm going to turn it around here. So it'll be on our digital page. It'll be on my Instagram.
Will it?
It will. It'll be on our the Facebook page as well and throughout Fox Sports Radio and everything we do. How golf explains Trump. You do realize that you don't even have to say anything. You say the word Trump and suddenly you lose half the people or you gain half the people.
Yeah, you immediately just go, oh, I hate you, I love you.
Right, correct.
But here's my thing. It's not a political book. It's a golf book about a guy who cheats like a mafia accountant. And I saw it personally. And then he started telling people on the campaign trail, I've won 20 club championships. I beat the best guys in my club all the time. Vote for me. I'm a winner. I'm like, you liar, because you told me how you did it. Do you know how he does it?
No.
He buys a golf course. He owns 14 clubs.
Right. I played
one of them. He buys
the
club.
Yes.
Plays the first round by himself. Declares it the club championship.
It's kind of genius, to be honest.
It's
it's
diabolical.
Diabolical.
Right? So one time he was playing Trump Philadelphia, and they were holding it at Trump Bedminster, and he calls in at the end of his round in Philly, and he's like, what won the tournament today? Club championship. And the guy goes, oh, Joe Schmo shot 74. Oh, I shot 73 up here. Make me the champion. And the head pro's like, what? Yeah, make me the champ. I played better than that. So they take Joe Schmo down and put him up. And it just goes on and on like that. He won one while he was with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. And they were holding it at the one in Mar-a-Lago. So you're like, you don't get to say you're a champ if this is all like Russian history.
Okay, so where do you begin with the book? Where does it start? Does it start like in the very early ages or when he first started playing golf? Like what is the point of beginning when you pick up the book? Where am I going to start when I learn about this book?
I was retired. I'm living in Italy half the year playing piano, playing golf, screwing around. And I kept getting these tweets about Trump's the champion. I'm like, no, he's not. Oh, Trump's a 2.8. He goes, I beat most people I play against.
2.8?
Like, yeah, if he's a 2.8, Tiger's a rabbi. Because I'm a 5.4, I can beat him. I bet him $100,000 I could beat him. He can't cover a two. Tiger, Annika Sorenstam, those guys say he's about a 10. He ain't no 2.8. You know how he does it? If you go on the gin.com where you report your scores, you got to have 20 scores to get a handicap. It's taken him 8 years to get 20 scores, which means he's just...
And he plays all the time.
He played 66 times last
year. He actually does the opposite of what everybody I know does, which is report...
Sandbag.
Report all your bad stories. Like, yeah, I'm like a 13. You're right. Like, so dude, 13, get out of here. So stripe the ball.
Exactly. So in golf, you call that a cocktail handicap. If he's a 2.8 in my club, phone would be ringing all the time to get him to the course for $100 Nassau. 2.8? He's 72 years old. He's not bad.
So the Trump defender would say Clinton cheated at golf.
I did, yeah.
Who cheats worse?
Okay, I played with Clinton as president.
Right.
Clinton only got to play like once every 2 months. And so he wanted it to last. Trump plays in 3 hours. Clinton played in six. And he's hitting all these... He'd play his first ball. And he had 24 clubs, by the way, way over the limit. And he'd hit what we call Billigans. And he'd hit these extra shots. And we're like, oh my God, where's the first one? Because he wanted to play the first one. But the Secret Service would always be like, I think it's on the green, sir. Because everybody wants to be ambassador to Sweden or whatever. Right. And so he played pretty well that day. But I always say, like, Clinton is the guy that goes to the bank and steals the pen. And Trump goes and steals the vault. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I always feel there's a certain charm to how Clinton does it. Where there's a...
Did you play with him?
No, I just... I know... Here's my knowledge of Clinton is because I played for Eddie Sutton.
Right.
Who was buddies with him back when they were both at Arkansas.
Arkansas, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we would... he wasn't... I'm trying to think. He wasn't in office. He was not in office. When was he in office? I'm trying to think. I think he was in office when I was first...
Let's see.
In school there. Was it 92?
92 through 2000.
Yeah, so he was. That was, you know, my career there. So if we'd win a big game on national TV, like you beat Oklahoma on Big Monday, he'd leave a message and coach would call us all in and play for us the message. Or he'd be on the phone and he'd put us on speakerphone and he'd congratulate him. And again, like there was a certain charm to even if he didn't really watch the game, somebody kind of gave him the bullet points. And then they'd start joking around, and he'd quickly pick up the phone because he didn't want the rest of us to hear all the other stuff he was talking about.
But let me tell you the difference between Clinton cheating and Trump cheating. Trump cheats like to win. He's gotta win. Like losing to him is a bath to the Wicked Witch of the West. Like he's not gonna lose. So he has this he screws around with a governor on a golf cart. Have you ever done that?
To make it faster?
Yeah. So it's 50 miles an hour and yours is 20. So him and his caddy are way ahead, and they're throwing it out of the woods. And he's a terrible chipper. Terrific driver of the ball. Terrible chipper. Throw it out of the rough. He kicks it so often, the caddies at Wingfoot call him Pele. So he's doing all this stuff. And then sometimes, if he's way ahead and you're clear back here 200 yards, he'll take your ball and kick it in the bunker.
Oh, that's wrong.
That's diabolical. He did it to Tirico.
To Mike Tirico?
Yeah.
He's like the nicest dude.
The greatest dude ever.
Ever. Okay, so give me one more story. Commander in Chief is the book, How Golf Explains Trump, written by Rick Riley. It's already on the New York Times bestseller list, number six with a bullet. Give me one more.
Okay. Well, it's not just about how he cheats on the golf course. There's all kinds of ways he cheats when he builds courses. But he tried, he did cheat Tiger Woods. Last 2017, playing with Tiger, Dustin Johnson, and Brad Faxon. And it's Dustin and Tiger versus Faxon and the president. And so Faxon and the president are way over here. Dustin and Tiger way over there.
That kind of feels like a bit of a mismatch. Yeah, DJ and Tiger.
They play the black tees.
Okay.
And Faxon and Trump play the white tees, and Trump gets 8 shots.
Okay.
Seems still like a mismatch.
Still seems like a mismatch.
So they're left. Trump and Faxon are right. Trump fats his approach into the water. He goes, throw me another one. They didn't see. And Faxon's like, what? Throw me another. So he throws him another, fats that one into the water. Now they've seen. He drives up quickly to the lake, drops, hits it on. Tiger hits it like this for a kick-in birdie. And when they get to the green, Tiger says, what do you lie there, Mr. President? He goes, I'm putting for 4. He told him he's putting for 4 when he's putting for 7. Like, what the F? So I don't know. Say what you want. To me, golf is like bicycle shorts. It reveals a lot about a guy. And it reveals a lot about
yeah,
Donald
it's,
Trump.
Yeah, it's like booze. Booze will do that as well, right? Who you are as a drunk is who you are as a dude.
You think so?
Yeah. If you're an angry drunk, you're an angry dude. If you're a funny drunk, you're a lighthearted dude.
Well, I can remember Arnold Palmer saying, I never do a business deal until I've played golf with a guy. And I said, why? He says, because you can't hide who you are in 4 hours. If you're going to cheat me, you're going to cheat out here. If you're going to cheat out here, you'll cheat me in business. If you're going to have a bad temper, you're going to be bad to deal with. If you're a great guy who plays by the rules, I'm going to enjoy it.
Pretty good stuff. The book is Commander in Cheat, How Golf Explains Trump. It's written by Rick Riley. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
That was fun. Thank you.
The pleasure was all mine.